Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I don't believe when we came over we were reformed. I think we were conservative at that point. We were never orthodox. We don't show any history, family history of being orthodox. But in any event, it was a short time after we opened up our jewelry store. Roberts had already opened up their jewelry store, the John M. Roberts Company, down at Wood and Smithfield in the 1830s. So we opened up 5 years after they did. So Roberts was the first jewelry store in Pittsburgh, and the DeRoy's was the second jewelry store in Pittsburgh, as well as I said before, so we had the jewelry store, and we also had pawn shop. Yeah, that's a heck. I'd like to find out something nicer than pawn shop, but I guess that's what it was. It was considered part of society.
It was in quite any a business
event,
then.
In any event, the one store was opened by Israel, mm-hmm. way back, and then of course as the family grew, they split. And then you had the S.H. DeRoy Jewelers, and you had the Joseph DeRoy, which were cousins. So we had two jewelry companies, but essentially.
S.H. DeRoy and?
And Joseph DeRoy. Mm-hmm. That was the other side of the family. Mm-hmm. And as I said, in 1865, some of our family was still in New Jersey, and as I showed you on that, and I think my wife made some copies if she was able to. I had a great-great-grandfather who served as a lieutenant from New Jersey in the Civil War. And he did serve in the South. There was no question about it.
And he came home alive?
Yeah.
No, he fought for the South or against the South?
No, he served in the South, I said. He shot in the North. New Jersey was a northern state.
Yes, okay.
In any event, he was on our side. Mm-hmm. I think he was with General Grant. But in any event, he did come back, and then that group moved later on to Cleveland. So we had a group in Pittsburgh, a few older ones left in New Jersey, and now some of the DeRoy's were now in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And the Cleveland DeRoy's later moved to Detroit. But we stayed here, and through the years we were in the jewelry business, and of course my dad was born in 1901, and eventually he went to medical school, which for a commercial family in those years, doctors were considered.
What was your father's first name?
Mayer, same as mine. His middle name was Sondheimer.
Mayer Sondheimer.
Sondheimer DeRoy.
S-O-N-D.
I'm not sure. You have to check.
H-E-I-M-E-R.
Something like that, Mayer Sondheimer.
DeRoy.
And, of course, for a long time, the family was angry at him because he became a doctor. Mm-hmm. Well, many, many years ago, there was not only in the Jewish families, but Italian families and Polish families, there was tradition. Mm-hmm. And if we were in the carpet business, you damn well better be in the carpet business, and your kids better be in the carpet business. And I, mm-hmm. and the doctor didn't mean that much mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. But in any event, and then later on,
they
course,
didn't make what they make today. They didn't drive Cadillacs then.
No, they didn't. And of course, the folks belonged to the Concordia Club, which originally used to, you know it as in Oakland, came right. from the north side.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, it was up on on Ridge Avenue on the north side with some of those mansions up there. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, Rhoda Scholem on Fifth Avenue, it's down there on 8th Street. The building's still there. And that's where my Aunt Bessie, passed away. She died in her 90s. She went to Rhoda Scholem down there on 8th Avenue. Wow. And I guess it's a warehouse or something now, but that was the original Rhoda Scholem. You know what it is?
To Rhoda Scholem.
Mm-hmm. On the building.
On 8th Avenue.
Yeah, 8th Avenue, downtown Pittsburgh. It's still standing.
Yeah, there's a picture of it in the at Rhoda Scholem.
Is there? Mm-hmm. I was confirmed. I probably saw the picture a dozen times. It meant nothing to me until I found out my family belonged to that one. You mm-hmm. know, and the fact that it's no longer used as a synagogue. Mm-hmm. I also had an uncle who was one of the First Credit Dentists, Doc DeRoy. And he had his offices on in the teens and 20s on in the 30s on Fifth Avenue downtown. Fifth and Market, I think it was, on the second floor. And he advertised on streetcars and buses and things like that. And that was acceptable to the family because he was in, at least in a business, but he, you know, a doctor that didn't advertise, well, that wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, they weren't too, no.
But,
When he went to medical school, did he become that kind of surgeon?
Who was that? My uncle?
Your father.
My father, he became an orthopedic surgeon, yes.
Orthopedic surgeon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What is an orthopedic?
That's a bone doctor.
Oh, bones.
Bone doctor, broken legs, ulnar radius, so on and so forth. That was his vocation and his avocation. That was his hobby as well as his profession. My father was a true professional man. As a matter of fact, there was arguments in the family when he passed away as, oh no, you just put Mayor S. DeRoy, M.D. I said, you put Dr. Mayor S. DeRoy because, you know, even I call Dad Doctor.
Is there anything you want to say about Marilyn, your sister?
Yeah, Marilyn, she went to, she was a good student. She went to Mount Mercy Academy. And later on, she went to Miami University, where she graduated and met her first husband.
Miami University in Miami or in Miami, Ohio?
Oh, no, Florida. Florida. I forgot about Miami, you in Ohio. It's like they say Indiana, you here in Pennsylvania, and yet it's the county of Indiana, not, you know, not the state of.
That's right. And married.
And she married Byron Chudom, C-H-U-D-O-M. Who came from Gary, Indiana. He was an attorney and a very successful attorney. Unfortunately, why he passed away in about 6 years ago, a young man, brain cancer. And she's since remarried and she's living happily now in Chicago. She has two children, my niece and nephew. Both of whom are married.
I wonder why somebody knew that. In other words, I was prompted to ask that question. I'm trying to wonder what it was they wanted to know.
What question?
About Marilyn.
Yeah.
Well, they knew Marilyn. Probably dated her.
Whoever wrote these notes for me.
Yeah, somebody probably knew Marilyn.
Must have known her.
Sure. Okay. She's 58. I'm 62. And her niece has two children.
Has two children.
So you only had one sister. That was it.
That's all I could stand. Remember, it was a depression. We couldn't afford anymore.
I had five.
that's tough. That's tough living.
She lives in Chicago now.
Yes, she lives in Chicago now. And her husband's name is Meyer Garfin, G-A-R-F-I-N.
Oh, you remember all that stuff.
Yeah, right. And
Meyer.
Yeah, he's a big dealer in Ethan Allen furniture. He has several stores. But I think his name was Garfinkel, and he shortened it.
Many of us do.
Well, that's what I mean. That's an unusual name, but I know many Garfinkels.
Me too.
So therefore, I think he might have. I won't hold that against him.
No.
That's no charge on that one.
Okay. Shut that off a little.
Okay. One person who stands out in my mind was. Two safety directors I served under. I'm sure that most people remember their name. One is David Craig.
Yes, I do remember.
Hey, I remember.
Yeah, and Dave Craig was a very good friend of mine. Matter of fact, he lived not far from here when he, before before he moved from Highland Park, he lived on Jackson Street. He is now the Chief Justice of the Commonwealth Court. And mm-hmm. I have the utmost respect for him, mm-hmm. both as Director of Public Safety and, of course, later mm-hmm. as an appellate court judge. Mm-hmm. And I think he served the public well. Mm-hmm. I think he did a masterful job of with the police. You know, he was the Director of Public Safety in charge of the police department and fire department, and he put mm-hmm. both of those organizations in order. Mm-hmm. Did an excellent job. Another person who was who came prior to Dave Craig was Louis Rosenberg, mm-hmm. who was the Director of Public Safety, mm-hmm. who was an attorney for the city, later on Director of Public Safety. I worked under him. Matter of fact, he swore me in. Mm-hmm. And then later became a federal court judge. Mm-hmm. He was down the street, federal court for many years. Very mm-hmm. fine, very fine person. Mm-hmm. And fond memories of these people. They didn't do anything outstanding, you know, that they're going to get plaques for, but I think that they are outstanding Pittsburghers, mm-hmm. and they certainly should get honorable mention, because I think they're both fine, fine mm-hmm. people. Then there was the superintendent with whom I worked until he was later fired by Flaherty, and I think you'll remember that. It's James W. Slusser.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Jim
Slusser. Why did your friend fire him?
Well, your friend said that he was... One of the reasons, I think there were three people. While Pete was electioneering, he said he was going to get rid of mm-hmm. James Slusser, the person that was the head of Urban Renewal. I forget what the name was.
That's Pete.
What?
Pete?
No, it wasn't Pete. It could have been, but I don't recall. But anyhow, James Slusser was outstanding, because I recall. But this was what we heard, and Pete always claimed that was rumor. That wasn't fact. No, he just, you know, he never said that. And then it appeared in the Courier, which is the Black community's yeah. newspaper. And lo and behold, and after they were, it appeared right after Pete won, before he was even able to tell them they were through mm-hmm. in November. So therefore, apparently it was mentioned somewhere. Somebody picked it up. But in any event, I had no idea why he fired Slusser, except that I have a recollection that for some reason or other, Kramer was the man that Pete ran against. Kramer was the Democrat, the endorsed Democrat, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and Judge Kramer, mm-hmm. Harry Kramer, right, now I remember it.
Harry?
Harry Kramer, Judge Harry Kramer, mm-hmm. right, and that's who Pete ran against. And I think one night there was a party or something, plus the fact that I think Slusser went overboard in working for Kramer. Mm-hmm. I think that angered Pete. Mm-hmm. But I think that wasn't so bad, because usually politicians make amends for that. They realize mm-hmm. that these things do happen. Mm-hmm. And what did occur was, I think, Loretha Slusser, or Boots Slusser, as she's known, as Jim's wife, mm-hmm. she was shooting her mouth off mm-hmm. about how she disliked Flaherty. Mm-hmm. And I think that rubbed him the wrong way more than anything during his whole campaign. Because it came back later on. You know, if she'd only kept her mouth shut, he'd still be the chief of police. Mm-hmm. Because obviously the chief of police works for the mayor, and the mayor can, you know, the mayor runs the police department. Mm-hmm. Who's kidding who? And when they ever say, take politics out of the police department, how the hell can you, when we all work for the elected officials? Mm-hmm. So you'll never take politics mm-hmm. totally out of a police department. Mm-hmm. But there was less under Sophie than any mayor I ever remember. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the reasons Slusser was fired. But he was probably one of the most capable and competent mm-hmm. chiefs of police that this city has ever seen. Plus, he served longer than any other chief of police. He served 18 years, and that's almost unheard of in the annals of police work. Because your chiefs today, if they serve anywhere from 3 to 5 years, boy, they've really served a long time. You know, and I think we've gone too far in many instances, particularly in politics. Well, vote the bastards out and put new ones in. Vote them out and put new ones in. Of course, you do that enough times, you've got no continuity in politics at all, and your city collapses.
Yeah.
You have to have a hardcore, you know, you have to have a hardcore leader, a leader, rather, who has a hardcore of good working people under him. And that's true in these corporations, where they keep getting rid of chief executive officer, and they keep putting in a new chief executive officer. Then they get rid of some of the people under him, and he brings his own people.
Yeah.
And now you have the blind leading the blind in a corporation where nobody knows what the hell's going on because it's all new to them. They don't leave enough of the cadre. Mm-hmm. Murphy may make that mistake. I don't think he will. Or anybody else that, you know, that becomes mayor. I think people are beginning to realize you've got to leave a certain amount of people who've been there for years there, because if you don't, you're going to have chaos. That's what it leads to.
I like that last patch. What you said. Mm. I'm not supposed to tell you that.
Oh, sorry.
You got a good 15 minutes there.
That's good.
All right, we want your opinion on the Pittsburgh Jewish life and its place in the general community now.
I think the city of Pittsburgh basically has a good, strong Jewish community. And I think this is one of the few cities where the Jewish life is dovetailed into the life of other people from other communities, and they seem to work and play together. There doesn't seem to be any, in my opinion, it isn't Serbian life and Jewish life and Catholic life and all that. I think Pittsburgh is a true melting pot. And I think Jewish life blends beautifully here. And I think the people are happy here. There's no question about it. And I don't think there's animosity here that may occur in other cities. Mm-hmm. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I think Jewish life here, so many of the Jewish people I know have Gentile friends, and many Gentiles have Jewish friends, and it's not one big blur where everything is lost. They still have their identities, but nevertheless, I think that the harmony is the thing that's important. It's the keynote and the blending.
You would know too that Maslow meld in with everyone.
Oh yes, very definitely. There's no question about it. Mayor Maslow, she blended in well in the Black community. She did it well in the Polish community, well in all of them. In other words, I think what happened is it is people looked at Sophie Maslow. She was unique. She had three things going for her. Number one, she was a female. Number two, she was a senior citizen. And number three, she was the first Jewish mayor we ever had. In other words, and you got three pluses in one lady, and a very fine lady. And I think people looked at her, and many people looked at her as a motherly or grandmotherly type, depending on their age. And the fact that she was a minority, in other words, a religious minority, that was fine. The fact that she was a senior citizen, she never let you forget, you know, and that was okay, because we're all going to be senior citizens someday, if we live long enough. That is.
He already has, and I
Yeah, I've passed that.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. With respect to this melting pot, it used to be an ideal. It no longer seems to be.
No, it's not. In many cities, you know, and I think the civil rights movement helped break up the melting pot. And I, whether wittingly or unwittingly, I think because the blacks were trying for a separate identity. And then when some of the ethnic groups saw that they wanted a separate identity, then the ethnic groups wanted a separate identity. And I think this is going on worldwide today. I don't think Germany was a melting pot, too, for many years, because many of the Turks came to Germany and they worked for lesser wages, you know, than the Germans did. Well, they didn't like it, but they got along, you know. And then other people came into Germany. That was then West Germany. Now it's all Germany. Now it's hell. But I think when you have all these ethnic groups, everybody striving, you know, for their own identity, then you no longer have a melting pot. Because everybody has to be identified. Wait, no, you know, you have to have so many, you have to have so many blacks, you have to have so many whites, you have to have so many Jews, so many Serbians, so many Croatians, Polish. I think it's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. Let's work together on our competence and our capabilities rather than our ethnic background. Our ethnic background and our ethnic heritage is great when the family gets together because that means something to them. But a Polish family getting together in Polish Hill, you know, on Easter Sunday doesn't really mean as much to me as it might on other days of the year when my family gets together. So that's where we'll keep our identity, within our families. But we don't have to make all our identities public.
Good point.
Yeah, but the effect on civic life and politics is there.
Now it is. It used not to be.
You think not?
Well, I think what you had years ago...
Wasn't it Irish for years and years?
Well, you mean here in the city?
Yeah.
I mean, across the country.
Well, Irish Catholic, yeah, but I mean, well, in Boston, too, was Irish Catholic. And that's unique, because Boston is very much like Pittsburgh. Tremendous concentration of Jewish families in Boston.
Yeah.
And, you know, but...
They didn't want to be police, that's all.
Well, a lot of them didn't want to be politicians, either, you know. So, I mean, what happened years ago, a lot of people didn't want to be policemen, so as a result... You had the Irish immigrants. I think that you'll find police forces usually reflected, and so did streetcar motormen. They reflected the immigration at the time. And I think your factories in Detroit, when the southern population started to move up there, the factories in New York, you saw a lot more black workers in those factories than you did in the steel mills here in Pittsburgh, because when you came up from the south, in order to get to Pittsburgh, you had to take two trains. In order to come up from the south to go to Detroit, you took one, or New York, you only took one train. And I guess they just couldn't transfer trains or something, but we had a large black population here for many years. But then again, you had your blacks and you had your immigrants living together on the hill, out in Homewood Brushton for many years, and there was no trouble. I mean, there were family fights, but I mean, that's only because neighbors historically have had feuds. And I think that'll go on forever. But nobody ever pulled a gun and shot their neighbor because their dog pooed on somebody's, sidewalk. But today, I think it's tragic. Our society, the fabric of our society, is weakening tremendously. Mm-hmm. And the funny part of it is it's a societal problem, and everybody looks to the criminal justice system to straighten out societal problems. And the criminal justice system, and the police in particular, were never designed to straighten out problems in society. All they tried to do is keep the two combatants apart so they didn't kill each other. Well, today they're getting together faster and shooting them before we can get there. Mm-hmm. But, years ago, anything that was wrong in the criminal justice system was the police. And there's always one problem with that. The police wear uniforms, so we know that he's part of the criminal justice system. Judges don't wear the uniforms out in the street. The district attorney doesn't. The corrections officials don't. The legislators don't. They're all part of the criminal justice system. But any time there's something wrong with it, they hang the police out to dry, and they shouldn't. Because many times it's the way a case is prosecuted, very weak prosecution. So as a result, that criminal didn't go free because the policeman erred when he's back on the street again. It's because the prosecuting attorney didn't do a good job in prosecuting the son of a bitch.
Can't be that.
And the judges, on the other hand, maybe they're not severe enough. We had a judge that was a visiting judge from Armstrong County for years, came down here, and they never put a stolen car thief in jail. Never did. Until one day he had his car up at the Civic Arena parking lot, and they stole it, and they stripped it, and he got it back. He could have put it in about 10 boxes and taken it home, except he left it here till they put it together again when they found it. From that time on, no attorney would take their client in front of this judge, because he was putting everybody in jail because his car was stolen.
Is this an anecdote or is it a true story?
It's a true story. Absolutely a true story.
Can you think of his name?
No, I can't.
Can't put the finger on him.
No. If I could, I wouldn't, because I don't want that to appear.
But isn't the big trouble...
By the way, since that time he's dead.
The big problem...
In Allegheny County, many times we didn't have enough judges, and we always had visiting judges who were paid $50 a day. And as long as the Supreme Court approved, they moved into Pittsburgh, or they moved down here, say, from Erie, Crawford County, and all of that, and they spent a month here. And they got $50 a day plus expenses. In other words, the county paid for the hotel room, and they stayed here for a whole month. And they heard cases with the same authority as our elected judges. Mm-hmm. Now, with all the judges that we have, although maybe not a sufficient amount, they don't have very few visiting judges. I haven't heard of a visiting judge in the last 5 years.
But isn't the problem that we don't have enough jails to put all these people into?
Today that may be a problem. It wasn't during the time I was talking about that stolen car.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the problem. Plus, today we're getting very mercenary, because the judge is sitting up there figuring, what's this guy doing in here? So the guy stole his car. Insurance is taking care of it. You see, now we have insurance companies in the thinking of judicial decisions, which is bad. I don't give a damn if you're paid for your car, but the guy that stole it, look what he did to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And if the insurance company pays you money, it won't be 100% of what that car is worth, even if it's 2 years old. You earned a part of it. Mm-hmm. That part is always wrong.
Well, we're all being stolen from in the price of the insurance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, we're the ones that will suffer. the same as burglaries. But I think...
Are there any interesting police cases that you might want to remark about? Something that you had to solve, or a person, or any police case whatsoever?
Well, when you get into the number of cases that have occurred through the years, there are so many of them. Some that they're anecdotes that are very, very funny. Some are very serious. Some are very pathetic. But there's always a multitude of them. The longer you're with the police department, the longer you serve the public, the more you run across them. And at the present time, you know, I'm somewhat at a loss to remember anything that was hysterical. Or some of the things that were very sad. We've seen a lot of tragedy. You see a lot of pathos in this job, more than you see things that are, you know, that are funny. But policemen can take a serious incident and make light of it and then laugh, only because they've got to laugh because you want to cry inside the other 50% of the time. And some of the ways that some of our police officers tell a story that happened to them, it's hilarious. And it's something you can make a half-hour sitcom out of, and it'd probably be the funniest thing in the world. And maybe it didn't exactly occur that way, but then they add a little, take a little away, and it comes off, and it's good. But I think one of the biggest things that I recall, we really worked hard. We were just rookies. We found Tony Grosso's numbers headquarters. And I'm going to tell you something. I had never seen such a slick operation. Had this man taken time and directed his, you know, efforts to a business, he would be probably one of the wealthiest men in this city. He was one hell of an organizer. And we had to go to county jail. We had so many number slips that we brought back in that raid. We raided him on a Friday. And I guess it was probably $1 million or more worth of number slips for a 10-day period. That we had to go back up to county jail and take three of his people out of county jail and bring them down to our office to run those slips. Because we could have never run them. I mean, they were so fast on the machine, it was just unbelievable. We could have never done that. So we never told the court that, and the court never asked us, and it's perfectly legal. There's nothing. But it's just, if you got a jury and they're saying, well, they got criminals in jail, and then they let them out to finish it. But there was another thing, too. And I told Jim Slusser, who was the boss, and I said, hey, boss, you've got to release those people. You've got to let them come down and run those slips because we know what the number was on Friday, you see. We want to make sure that all these people in the whole county don't start putting in hit slips and say, no, I played that number, you see what I mean? And because this will cause chaos. We weren't trying to protect the illegal operation. We just wanted to make sure it didn't get any more lousy than it already was. And we wanted to make sure that they didn't ruin a good arrest by putting in number slips that never occurred. And by God, we found out. Nobody tried it because they found out. That was one of the things we released to the underworld, that we had released. We released that information to them, that we had released three prisoners to come down and run those slips. And everybody says it's no good. You know, I'm sure they had that in mind. They'd have made thousands and thousands of dollars by doing that. We didn't think that was appropriate. Not on this arrest. It was really a good arrest.
What about drug? Drug stories?
Well, the only thing I can state about drugs, when I came on this job, the drugs were virtually unknown. I had a friend of mine who died from an overdose of drugs in 1957, shortly after I came on. His name was Charles Solomon. And we knew all along that he was a drug user, but we thought he was a marijuana smoker. Later on, we found out that he was a heroin mainliner, and he was only... Shoot, he couldn't have been more than, 18, 19, 20 years of age at that time. But they started a drug raid, and what happened was, the guys, when you get drugs, you usually adulterate them. You mix them with something. Yeah. And you take, I guess the drug is, if it's heroin, if you get a pack of heroin, it's about 10 to 12% pure drug. Mm-hmm. The rest is powdered sugar, or if not that, it's just powder. Well, what happened is this guy, he dropped all these packs that he had that hadn't been opened up to adulterate yet. And when he stuck that in his arm, he died instantly. That was 100% pure heroin. Mm-hmm. Your system can't take it. You die. Mm-hmm. But that was something I'll never forget. But anyhow, when we came on this job, the worst thing you could do was be caught with a marijuana cigarette. My God. I thought we had the right to execute you on the spot for that. We could shoot you. Mm-hmm. And, One thing that did occur one night, though, that I thought was pretty clever, the numbers, or the drug people had hit a house on Frankstown Avenue in East Liberty, and it was over a bar, and Big George, he was known, big black man, he owned this bar, and he also sold narcotics on the second floor. And I guess this was in the, this was probably in the late 50s, all right, now we were starting to find out that the blacks were starting to use heroin. That was something that we, you know, and we started to expand the narcotic squad. So they got out to this Big George's house one night, and I'd been on the number squad. So Big George was upstairs, and they couldn't find the narcotics. So this one sergeant, he was pretty clever. He says, you know, we're looking for narcotics, and we don't know how to look. Let's call the guys from the number squad, because they're good in finding these little stashes where they hide the number slips. So we went out there. By God, two of us found all this heroin, and it was quite a stash of heroin in the steps leading up to the apartment. It was very cleverly concealed. You had to push a little button, and with flashlights and everything, we carefully went over that place. And he said, "See, I told you. Get the guys that have to do this every day. So if you avail yourself to those people that have the ability beyond what you can comprehend it, but you just can't do it because you're not talented enough. And by God, we were able to get this. I'll never forget that. That was a big night."
Yeah.
Hit all the front pages. And, of course, we knew that we were into something big when we had Big George open his safe and he had $80,000 in cash.
Wow.
This is in 1950.